Hi there, everybody. This is Armand DeMel with you with The Positive Mind, WBAI 99.5 FM on your dial. Bringing you ideas, concepts, and guests to help you live a more positively minded life. Hey, my friends, I've got, just a little more music for you. Hold on a second, I'll be back within a minute. I'm back with you, my friends. Hi there. Hey, here's a question for you, giving advice. I keep watching people give advice. I just read another book about giving people advice on how to stop their addictions. And I noticed something about the book on addictions was that the book was written by somebody who clearly went to Oxford and never had an addiction problem in his life. Reminded me of an old friend of mine who many years ago said she had come up with the absolute secret to losing weight. And I, having been someone who has always had some kind of a battle with weight myself, has said, what's your secret? And she, this perennially thin, always, a woman said, it's very simple. You eat. And then when you're eating, you ask yourself, have I had enough? And when your answer is, yes, I have had enough, then you stop eating. I said, that's it? That's your method? She said, yes, that's all you have to do. She said, try it. Try eating and then ask yourself if you had enough. If you pause and you promise yourself you're going to wait 5 minutes before you eat any more, it works. It's a beautiful diet. That was a terrific idea. People who are sex-craved, well, ask yourself, do you really want this? People who go shopping, ask them, just stop and ask yourself, do you really want to buy this product? You see, people give advice about things that they possibly have never faced or seen. There are a lot of people I know who give advice on bringing up children, and they've never had a child. Couples therapists who are single, who've never been married, right? Family therapists who are alienated from their families. So the question is, how do you know, and how are you going to learn? And here's what we keep learning over and over again. We keep learning that what we knew in the past is not the same as what we now know. And here's a big one. Let's talk about the one about feeding the psyche, about food. Is it an issue of self-control? Is it an issue of willpower? How many of you struggle with weight, one form or another, either by working out in the gym and just working yourself till you're working into a frenzy, or eating minimal foods, or starving yourself, or so on and so forth. You don't know why. Why do you have more trouble with it than the other guy? So I've got a friend, Michael. He could sit there and he could eat anything he wants to eat. He never gains weight. And then there are other people who are struggling. On it. There are other people who are struggling about weights. And they're trying to find it over and over again. So here's the question. What is the difference between people who are struggling and not struggling? Can science explain why some people have to go snack on crackers and desserts and carbohydrates and fats while other people don't do it? Well, there's some new research, and the new research of my friends is just phenomenal. They're finding a direct connection between hormones and different types of foods. Yep. And since hormones are frequently the result of hormonal reactions are the result of having different emotional reactions, and emotional reactions are the result of having different hormonal reactions, your hormones and your food seem to be really linked, closely linked. So here comes the question now. If they are linked, how are they linked, and what is the way? For example, in Germany, there's a word that's called Kummerspeck. I think it's Kummerspeck. Kummerspeck. It means grief bacon. And it had to do with observations that World War I, widows of the husbands who went off to fight in the war frequently put on a lot of weight. And it was because they were eating a lot of fats while their husbands away, because the fat made them feel better. Now, this is no great news to you, right? You know, if you're a fatty, that food makes you feel better. You know it, but why does it make you feel better? The old theory was that food makes you feel, has some connection to early childhood, and in early childhood you had comfort foods, and that when you felt bad, you ate, and that makes you feel better, or you eat and it puts you to sleep, and that makes you feel better. Well, the science has kind of gotten good with this. Andrew Hill of the University of Leeds in London and his colleagues confirmed a study that negative emotions can provoke an eating attack. The researchers showed a group of 40 heavy female binge eaters either a sad or a neutral film and then ordered them food as a supposed taste test. And they found that the people who watched the sad films tended to eat twice as much as the people who watched the not-so-sad films. Now, why is this? Is this everybody? You know, do we have popcorn and for everybody in the theater? Is it everybody is going to overeat? No. Here's the way it works. It seems that there's a breakdown. Some people are not, some people are fuel eaters. Now, by that I mean they eat food for fuel. They eat food, they eat it because they know that food's going to make them keep going. And they keep their engine going. They're affecting their chemistry, but they're not really attached to one particular food or another. They eat the food as fuel. Other people eat food as a drug, as a chemical. You may have been a food fuel person or a food drug person. Which one do you think you are? A group of researchers, Georgina Oliver and her colleague at the University of England, they reported that anxiety and stress can lead to unhealthy eating habits among more ordinary consumers. The researchers categorized 68 healthy men and women as emotional and non-emotional leaders. They gave a mixed group a stressful task and prepared a four-minute speech. They were supposed to prepare a four-minute speech. Turns out that the people who were stress eaters ate a great deal when under that stress, and the fuel eaters ate a minimal amount of food because they didn't want the food to distract them. So there are changes in the brain chemistry that become, food becomes like a Prozac for many people. What becomes really important is learning which foods matter to you and which don't. Anne Catherine had written a book. I remember she wrote a book called The Anatomy of a Food Addiction. And she talked about brain allergies. She said, what is a brain allergy? It's a chemically induced reaction in the brain that manifests in emotional or behavioral changes, some of which can be extreme. Brain allergy now. She says a person with a brain allergy to sugar products, for example, can have intense paranoia, periods of rage, depression, hopelessness, paranoia. And so what she said was that there was a connection between the brain and the brain chemicals and the food that you eat, that the food is actually toxic. Other people say it's not toxic. It just affects your hormones. Let's look at sugar. I mean, sugar is really kind of amazing how it works. Remember how it works, how the emotional relief works with food. If you eat food, it takes a little time for the brain chemistry. It occurs after the food is digested. It's absorbed into the bloodstream, transported to the brain. Serotonin and stress hormone responses could underlie the slowing growing waistlines of people under chronic stress. If you're under chronic stress, you tend to eat more and you tend to get heavier. And it's the serotonin need that is called for. You're trying to calm down. You're trying to get a little more sane. Chocolate acts in other ways. Cocoa contains stimulant caffeine and theobromine, which affect brain chemistry. And they can contribute to people's liking for chocolate. Chocolate is a drug. Doesn't mean it's bad. But it is a drug. It affects you in a certain way. They had a group of people. They had a group of people. Dr. Hendrik Smith, University of Oxford, did a study on different chemicals of different people. They offered a caffeine drink with this theobromide in it to people. And they gave it as a morning drink to some people and a morning drink to other people. And they gave it, they didn't include the caffeine for other people. The people who got the caffeine soon became addicted to the caffeine drink and desired it and wanted it, especially when it had the theobromine in it as well. Now, these are just the chemicals. And these, of course, are the ingredients of chocolate, but you couldn't taste chocolate when you drank the drink. You just had a benign tasting kind of liquid. It didn't taste like anything special. Now, sugar may act like a drug in a different way. It involves a dependency under certain circumstances. In Princeton, Bartley Hobel and his colleagues he rats who were not used to eating sugar. He had trained these mice that are controlled from birth. They don't have any sugar. They feed them food. They added sugar to their diet. Once they added the sugar to the diet, the mice who had the experience with sugar would go and crave sugar over other more nutritious food. Whereas the mice who never had sugar, they did not crave the sugar. So it seems like sugar dependency is a learned dependency. Now you think about that when you're a kid. When you're a kid and you felt bad, what did your mother do? She brought you nice foods. She said, here, have a little of this. Have a treat. I'll make you a favorite pie. Sugar sometimes becomes associated with a relief of pain because of your conditioning. So it's not that people are born with these chemical conditions, that people are born with, you know, an addiction to a drug or a chemical. It's that people can be conditioned into it, but once you are conditioned into it, that's it. You've got a problem. You got a problem because now there is a child inside you who just wants to feel good. That's all. There's some kid inside you who feels miserable at times. And when this kid doesn't feel good, it wants to eat. It wants to find a way to feel better. For the people who have a food-drug connection, the way that the child feels better is to go and consume something that will make its mood change. It wants to change its serotonin, it wants to change its dopamine, it wants to feel better in some way. You know, red hot peppers, do you ever wonder why people like red hot peppers? They induce a secretion of endorphins. And what you get is a whole bunch of endorphins, which are very pleasant feeling kind of chemical, you know, endorphins like you get when you have an orgasm, endorphins like you get when you have, you know, if you have pain, it's that pleasant feeling that goes along with it, endorphins. Endorphins are great feeling stuff, right? Well, hot peppers will do that to you. Now, why would people want that? Because they want to feel that glow, that wonderful feeling. Now, if you imagine where the hot peppers most prevalent, they are the hot foods are most prevalent among the most impoverished countries. If you think about India and you think about Mexico, right, where people have very little, what is stimulating? What makes you feel good? You know, you have more peppers. Think about places where people are a little more fortunate, like the English people or the German people, where the hot foods are not as big. So down where you have the people who have less, they tend to be attracted more to things that will make them feel differently. Anything will make you feel differently. You know, plants will make you feel different. Marijuana will make you feel different. Smoking, of course. What do you think smoking? We consider that not to be food. It is ingestion of a drug. And, of course, who are the biggest smokers? Who smokes the most, you know? The people with the least smoke the most. The people who are, you know, in cigarette sales in China, cigarette sales in South America, cigarette sales are highest in places where people have the least high education. Now, you're going to say, well, education teaches you that people don't should not smoke. No, as well as that. It also is that the only way you try to affect your chemistry is through something primitive. I discovered something about cigarettes that is amazing. Cigarettes control wrath. Cigarettes control anger. It's very specific. If you stand with a cigarette smoker and you watch if they get angry about something, they're going to light a cigarette right when they get angry. And what's the first sign of someone when you start withdrawing from cigarettes? They get mad at everybody. Then there are people who withdraw from food and they get angry at everybody, right? You get this kind of anger, this almost uncontrollable rage pop-ups that you see. And you wonder, hey, you haven't eaten any food for a day. Maybe that's why you're rageful. You haven't smoked a cigarette for a day. Maybe that's why you're rageful. You could test it too, because all you have to do is have a little bit of a tobacco, a little bit of sugar, and see if you calm down. And you could tell if that's where your addiction is. So the real case that we have is a better compassionate understanding that people are different. And this is Armand DeMille with you with The Positive Mind. People are different, and people have inside them a thing I call the engineer. He's trying to save your life. He wants you to feel better. But he's going to do it in the most primitive way possible. And the most primitive way he knows is like he's either going to try to give you something that'll change your chemistry to make you feel different than you feel. You know what I'm talking about, don't you? What is your food? What's the food that you eat? What's the one that when it comes to you, if you feel bad, what's your best food? Now, many of you are going to say, if I feel bad, my best food is no food. Because it's true. To the fuel food people, there is no good food. Food, if you're feeling bad, makes you feel worse because you have to detract, you have to actually digest. They actually don't like it. But what's your favorite food? And how do you connect to your favorite food? And what's your history with that favorite food? What do you think the average we're going to take is? You think if we ask everybody, we're going to come up with one food that is a comfort food? Now, I've asked two questions. What is your comfort food? And what is your favorite food? Those may be different. See, like you may say, my favorite food is pizza. My comfort food is mashed potatoes. See, it may be different for you. It may be a different thing. But you could tell about your own chemistry by the food that winds up being your favorite comfort food. What do you, when you watch TV and you want to relax, what do you drink? You know, what do you eat? A lot of people have a drink. Alcohol is a food. Alcohol is, I mean, of course, I'm going to say it's no revelation. Alcohol is a drug. Alcohol is sugar. It's the purest form of sugar. It is so much sugar that it surges through your system. It affects your insulin. It affects all of the other parts of your body. I mean, it really does a number on you. I knew a man who used to go away, and he would go away on these wonderful holidays. And whenever the rest of the time he didn't drink at all, he'd go on these wonderful holidays. And the first night on the holiday, the first thing he would do that evening is he'd allow himself to have a glass of wine with the person he loved. And he used to have miserable second days, terrible second days. His second day, he couldn't sleep. He didn't feel good. He never understood why. They had a wonderful first night. But the second night of their going away together, he felt miserable. And he thought he just couldn't stand. In fact, they used to think it was a fear of intimacy. He was afraid. He got together on one night. And then finally, with some help, he isolated the fact that it was the alcohol that he drank the night before that seemed to give him a sleep that didn't feel good. And he woke up dysphoric, which means not too happy, and the rest of the day was spent feeling not so good. When he removed the midnight alcohol on the first day of the holiday, he found that he kept his joyous celebration with the person he loved. But it took years for him to discover that. He couldn't figure it out. He said, "What are we doing? We're going on vacation. Of course we're going to pop open a bottle of champagne. Or even overeat. Or even have a lot of sugar. Or go somewhere and binge that night." All of that chemical stuff that seems like it's going to make you feel good at the minute, which it very well may do, can have some kind of major emotional consequence on you a little later. Now, here's the trick. The trick is not "you're wrong, don't eat." The trick is to learn what does what. You see, maybe you want to have that drink of champagne the day your vacation ends, so you could go home and you'll work miserably instead of being on vacation miserably, if that's what it does to you. But you have to look at the effect not only immediately, 12 hours later and 24 hours later. What was it like? What was it like for you? People talk about being vegetarians, and some people talk about being meat eaters, and you know, you can make a claim for the fact that if you're a vegetarian, eating meat could affect you a certain way a day later. Not that you shouldn't eat meat, but it's going to have an effect that you could almost anticipate. And the worst of all, my friends, the biggest criminal, the biggest food effect that people could have, I believe, is salt. I believe, you know when salt became a thing in America? Around the Second World War. Believe it or not. Before the Second World War, we weren't such salt nuts. When they invented potato chips, yes, I was watching this recently, I was studying this, potato chips started off as one of the foods, one of those little foods. And the way that they got potato chips is the way they preserved them, the way they made these potatoes and put salt on them, and people snacked on them. And then from that, tens of thousands of snack foods were invented, all which were selling salt. And little by little, people began realizing that salt had a certain satisfaction to it and a certain craving to it, that once you took the salt, it made you want more salt. And it made you want more salt. And then you're holding water in your body, you see? And you're holding a lot of water in your body. And so you take more salt. And the salted, they call us the salted generations. Americans are salted people. We are, a salt was a deadly weapon. It is salt. Salt here. And I could tell you, if you want to try it as an experiment, and I'm not saying this from a nutritional point of view, see what it's like to live a day without salt. See what it's like, not even just take away added salt. See what one day without it is like. You'll be in the bathroom half the time because you just body, you know, the salt affects a thing called, what is that hormone? Antidiuretic hormone, ADH. ADH, and you have ADH, antidiuretic hormone, is secreted by salt, so salt will make you have ADH, antidiuretic hormone. If you take away the salt, you have diuresis, which means you pee, and the water starts dropping out of your body. The reason that people lose so much weight when they fast on the first day is not because they haven't eaten food, but because they haven't taken in salt, and they're releasing the water out of their bodies. A first-day weight loss of 4 or 5 pounds could be just because you've dropped all the water. So this is Armand DeMille with you. I want to hear from you, too. I want to talk to you about it. Let's go back to the thing about food for a minute. Just try these questions and see how they work for you. Do you have a desire to eat when you're depressed or disappointed? Always, sometimes, or never. Do you have a desire to eat? Do you have a desire to eat when you feel lonely or let down? You have a desire to eat when you're worried or emotionally upset? Do you have a desire to eat when you're restless or bored? Does boredom or restlessness lead you to it? Do you have a desire to eat when you're afraid? And you have a desire to eat when you're irritated or angry? Try to see if you can isolate which emotions are the ones that are the most likely to trigger your food addiction. I know some people, when they're sexually stimulated, they tend to binge on food. They're trying to almost control the excitement that they feel because they know they have to wait. So then they control it by eating food. They're trying to keep themselves down. Another interesting thing we've learned about humans, and this is a fascinating thing about humans. See, according to the way our nervous system works, we have a sympathetic nervous system and a parasympathetic nervous system. Digestion takes place in the parasympathetic nervous system. However, fear, anxiety, and everything takes place in the sympathetic nervous system. So if you wanted to go from sympathetic nervous system to parasympathetic nervous system, where rest is and we feel sleepy when you can recover, only humans do it. You force yourself to eat when you're nervous. Only humans do that. Animals don't do that. Animals don't eat when they're nervous. Animals don't eat when they're under attack. They don't stop for a snack. Humans do, because what humans want to do is they want to trigger their own digestion by force feeding. You know, they force feed themselves. They eat pasta and pasta and more pasta and stuff like that. And then they finally get it in their body and gets to a certain point where they feel this thing release, where suddenly they've gone from sympathetic nervous system to parasympathetic nervous system, and now they feel relaxed again. They go from nervous to binge eating for that very, very reason. This is Armand DeMille with you with The Positive Mind. We're going to take a short break in just a couple of minutes, and when we come back, we're also going to be taking your calls. The two books I recommend The Anatomy of Food Addiction by Anne Catherine. It's the brain chemistry of overeating. It's a good book, and I like the four-day win. We had that author on our program the other day who taught us that everything you do takes kind of 4 days for you to get to it, you know. So if you don't go on a diet or you're fasting, it takes 4 days for you to get into the swing of it. And so if you're trying to give up foods for 4 days, you're trying to change an addiction, it takes 4 days. And she wrote a book called The 4-Day Win. What's the name? Martha Beck. Right? Terrific. She's appearing all over the place, and she was with us. So I recommend these two books, but I'm also going to recommend, and I want to talk to you about the child in you who needs these satisfactions when we get back in just a couple of minutes. So this is Armand DeMille with you with The Positive Mind. I'll be back with you with a little special music as soon as I get back. Sound familiar, my friends? That's Lambada. Lambada by Kaoma. K-A-O-M-A. From the Putumayo World Music Collection of World Hits. You're going to be hearing a lot from us with Putumayo. We've just developed a wonderful relationship. I love their music. You know, they bring music from all over the world on so many different levels. I have some children's music that just knocks me out. In fact, I don't even know where it is. There's some beautiful stuff here. Hey, the telephone number here is 212-209-2900. I want to take your calls as well. We're talking about food and food kind of being your drug. We're talking about how food is your drug and how you get to use food as a drug, and how now that you think about it, you think about it as a drug state, as a drug thing. So let's see if we can get some of your calls in here. 212-209-2900. This is Armand DeMille speaking with you with the Positive Mind. Let's hear. Hi there. You're on the air. This is Armand DeMille.
Hi, Armand. Thanks for having an interesting program today.
Good.
About food. One thing, though, you said something about pepper. And from what I understand, the reason why some people eat peppers in some of the so-called poor countries is that most of the time, these countries are hot. Like, they get very hot, warm weather in the summertime, and it increases your circulation, and it makes you feel cool. I think also that's one reason why we tend to eat it a lot during the summertime.
Oh, that's kind of interesting. So you're saying, as well as the fact that the habanero may make you feel, because, you know, you just can't imagine eating burning hot food, chilies, in the summer, but you're right. It is a very popular.
Increases your circulation. It's
summer
also
food, so it increases your circulation as well, and therefore that cools you down on some level. So it must work on many different levels.
Thank you.
Okay, sure. 212-209-2900. Great. Let's take another call. Hi, this is Armand DeMille. You're on the air.
Hi, Armand. It's Claire.
Hello, Claire.
Something funny just happened. I turned the radio on. I was listening to you, and I was getting dressed to go out to get a cheeseburger, which I shouldn't have. And suddenly, I didn't want the cheeseburger. I said, what the heck is going on?
What's happening?
And then I said, well, you'll get the cheeseburger, but jog first. And I said, this is all from listening to Armand. So my question to you is...
Okay, now wait a minute.
Yeah.
You wanted to get the cheeseburger because of me?
No. I was at 10 o'clock this morning. I wanted the cheeseburger.
All right. So there's your chemistry. You know, there's the thing. That's like at 10 o'clock this morning, you woke up. What were you feeling?
Lonely. I eat from loneliness and boredom.
So you know that if you get lonely and bored, that you could get a certain kind of food that will kind of take your system and make you feel not so lonely and bored.
I get a hit right in the zone, right?
Right. And how do you have your cheeseburgers when you eat them?
I have it on the darn white roll, and I'll have, thank God I don't go into the French fries, but I have it medium rare.
Medium rare. So you actually like also the taste of the meat and like that whole thing triggers stuff in you. You know, there are people.
I love the taste of food, Armand. I love it.
Well, you see, let's try it this way.
Okay.
You love yourself better when you have certain foods.
This is true.
And it's not that you love food, because I'm sure if you had, you know, like you can love a dog, and then you could love food. Which one do you love more? You could love a human, and you could love food. You could love a baby, and you could love food. They're funny words, you know. It's
yeah.
a funny word, that word love.
Yeah.
But there is something about the way it makes you feel that feels complete. Now, let me ask you a question. As a kid, where were cheeseburgers in your life?
Right next to the cake, which I love equally as well.
All right.
And my mother did give us a lot of food.
But your mother didn't make cheeseburgers.
No, not cheeseburgers. Maybe hamburgers she made.
She made hamburgers?
I think so.
And she had them sitting around with the cake?
Oh, no.
That
she just would fry them.
Huh?
But my real love
but
of food...
But let me ask you this about your father.
Yeah. Alcoholic.
And did he like hamburgers?
He liked any food. He had a terrible childhood. He just loved food. And he ate it with such adoration.
Gusto.
Really, he did.
He ate it with such what?
Adoration. He adored food because as a child he was so poor.
With food.
What?
See, now your father was a guy who was very chemical kind of guy. Right. He liked alcohol. Alcohol, he tried to balance his chemistry.
Right.
And he also liked food. I mean, he liked it more than he liked people as much. Because these were predictable things he could do to his body.
Right.
When you watched your father eating, and you joined him in an eating frenzy,
right,
wasn't that fun?
Yes, and I was always aware that he was in a trance state over the food. He loved the food more than me. I was aware of that.
So the only way you could join him was to eat as well.
That's sad, isn't it?
No, it is sad. It's sad that we can't get loved.
That we have to get hurt so early.
Well, yeah, and it's also kind of amazing that you found some chemical way of making you feel at peace.
Yeah, for a short amount of time, though.
For a few minutes.
Because I'm overweight.
So one of the things that they say is, they say, okay, if that's what the burger does,
right,
you know, are you going to try to see what abstinence and replacement of the burger with another food, not to lose weight, but find another food besides the burger that might also, that you could also have that would fill you. And it might be, like for you, it might be a turkey sandwich. And it's not going to have exactly the same thing, but it might have a similar feeling. And one of the things you want to test is, how does that specific food, is it the only one that'll work these chemicals for you?
And if it's not, if I get to find another?
If you could find some alternate food, knowing where the addiction is, you see? Wherever we have the addiction, you want to find an alternate food. I used to think that I couldn't do anything but eat meat. Then I went to one of Gary Null's festivals where he was cooking food, and he once presented, I remember, a bean dish of some sort that turned my head around. I said, this is as good as a burger.
Wow.
There are some veggie burgers out there that turn me around. Now, I'm not one of these, you know, who telling you you shouldn't have it.
Right.
But it's great to experiment and to see what works for you.
Yeah, to get some inner freedom. Okay, I hear that.
Thanks for calling in.
Thank you.
Right. Yes, you know, and around food, the biggest damages are done. Not that it's around food, but, you know, if you think about what people do with food, force you to eat food. I remember liver when I was a kid. Oh, my God. Somebody came up with a theory that every kid's got to eat liver. And we were poor kids, so we only got the worst cut of liver. Right? And did you eat your liver? Well, I could tell you, my dog rejected the liver. We would have this problem of trying to, because whatever we didn't want to eat, we fed the dog, you know, under the table. That was a sensible thing to do, but even he didn't want to eat the liver. And this whole battle that used to take place around eat your liver, eat your fish, eat this, you know, things that you do to kids. I mean, I don't think parents do that anymore. Or maybe they do. 212-209-2900, Armand DeMille. Hi there, you're on the air. Hello there, you're on the air. 212-209-2900, this is Armand DeMille.
Hello.
Calls. Hi there, you're on the air.
Yeah, my name's Alan.
Hello,
I was,
Alan.
Curious about eating and mood disorder.
Sure.
Because there was a book years ago, I never got a chance to read it. It's called Sugar Blues. I tend to be a high sugar consumer.
You are. Now, you know, did you ever notice your rhythm of it? Now, you're a high sugar consumer. When do you eat the most sugar? Evening,
so
midday?
Throughout
what did you
the
say?
Day. Throughout the day.
Throughout the day. When you wake up, do you have a lot of sugar?
Yeah.
You put sugar in coffee?
I don't add sugar to coffee, but I get it in just about every other way.
What,
and cookies and cereals.
So you'll have whatever you could do. You need. You know that sugar maintains you, sustains you, keeps you going, right?
Okay.
How about alcohol?
Well, I'm in recovery from alcohol, and depression has probably been a part of my whole makeup all my life.
So alcohol, you know, alcohol and sugar are so closely related. You've had to give up alcohol. And one of the things I used to remember about the AA meetings, it always used to surprise me. I don't think they do it as much anymore. They always used to have a lot of sugar and coffee around. you know, at the meetings. There used to be so much sugar there. And I used to say to myself, you know, there's one little piece missing here. People are trying to get off alcohol, but they're being given sugar. And sugar and alcohol are very closely related, that if you're really trying to give up alcohol, you should curtail the sugar as well, because the sugar keeps the alcohol craving alive.
It's been over 9 years.
And you've been able to do it for 9 years just living on sugar. Look, some of the best people I know are sugar addicts. I know people who treat drug addiction who are just, you know, tremendous sugar addicts. And by sugar addicts, when I say that, I mean you keep your body in balance through sugar. Now, you would rather not do that? Is that the way? Is that what part of the reason you're falling?
Absolutely.
Yeah. And what's the difficulty, Alan? What happens? What happens to you when you try not to have sugar?
A lot of it is mood. A lot of it is mood.
Yeah. And nothing you know will substitute for the mood?
Well,
nothing will take
you out. What I've been doing a lot of lately is cycling, exercise, vigorous exercise.
Vigorous exercise helps you?
Yes.
Is it vigorous exercise with or without sugar?
Well, still with sugar, but I seem to be better without it.
Yeah. Okay. So, see, you know, I think what you're doing is making evidence for the fact that what we're saying is true, that there is a mood gets associated to chemicals. And, yes, every one of us and foods and every one of us knowing this will eventually want to challenge our food addiction toxicity kind of stuff. But it's great to understand that it's not a matter of just willful self-control and willpower. That really, this is the way you were conditioned. Now, as a kid, was a lot of sugar available to you?
I think so. I was a kid in the 50s, and that's, I think, when they started coming out with all the processed stuff. It got really big. It's probably in the 40s and 50s.
In the 40s and 50s, you know, which is kind of interesting, where we had all the salted foods and all the candies. And where did you grow up? What neighborhood?
Bronx.
In the Bronx?
Part of it, and over here in Jersey, the rest.
And candy stores and candy stores. Candy stores. True candy stores.
A staple of the neighborhood.
It was a staple of the neighborhood. Do you remember a thing called Mellow Rolls?
Vaguely.
I wonder if they ever were around. It was a form of ice cream that kids used to eat all the time. It came in the form of a barrel. Just really funny things. But when we grew up, you know, when you had a dollar and you were going to the movie, do you remember what you would do for candy if you had a dollar or 25 cents? What would you buy for yourself? See if you could remember.
Usually something with chocolate.
Like what?
Oh, I don't know. Whatever
what are those
popular brands are today
called?
That have been around forever.
You would get a chocolate thing. You would probably get a sweet thing and a salt thing. You know, salt was also just beginning to come around as part of the addiction. And if you have sweet and salt mixed together, you form a beautiful attachment.
Yeah.
Beautiful. I mean, I wish we didn't have it. But I know it's the reason why American people are considered a very overweight nation. Salt and sugar and fat. That's what we do. Give them salt, sugar, and fat, put it together, and we will become addicted to it. But it's nice that we're learning.
The whole idea of sugar seems to be so tied into my mood. I don't know if it drives me to depression or the depression drives me to it more.
Well, I think you're making a very good point because it's exactly that. It both drives you to depression and the depression drives you to it. You have a relationship with sugar. You're kind of married to it. You're having an affair with sugar. You know?
That's a nice way of putting it.
But, you know,
that's
like
the way I felt about alcohol.
Same way you felt about alcohol. Did you ever smoke cigarettes,
too? Yeah, I
kept
to realize after years, but that's essentially what it comes down to.
Were you a cigarette smoker as well?
Yes.
You gave up cigarette smoking as well?
Yeah, this time I gave them both up at the same time. So
alcohol and cigarettes. Wow, that's amazing. That's like giving up a lover, you know that? You know, I mean, it's like giving up. I mean, cigarettes are, to many people, the only thing in the world that makes them feel good. And alcohol, to many people, is the only thing in the world that makes them feel good. And it's like having a lover. It's like if you're married and you have a cigarette and an alcohol habit, it's like you have a menage a trois. You have another entity in the house. And you know that, and I know that. And so you have this relationship with alcohol and with cigarettes. And it's like your cigarette becomes your best friend. You feel upset, you smoke a cigarette. You feel...
Absolutely.
You know? And it's like when you give that down, when you put it down, and I remember I used to smoke many years ago. When I put down that cigarette and I said I'll never smoke again, I used to see people smoking and I'd say, you know, you lucky guy that you could afford to do that. You know, how lucky for you that you could do that for now. And I hope that eventually you stop before it takes a toll on you. Most people who stop smoking judge everybody else. But I don't judge them. I mean, I look at people's addictions as part of the way they're getting by in the world.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
I tried to give up sugar a couple of years ago, and two very dear friends of mine in recovery suggested I go back on sugar because I was getting dangerously angry.
Dangerous. You see, now that's a very important thing. Dangerously angry are a very interesting mixture of two words. Yes, you do have to go through that. You have to go through that anger. That's where a therapist really helps. Takes you through stuff that related to that, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But it isn't, you can't, you know, just, if dangerously angry, I mean, you may as well drink and smoke, too.
Well.
Because that controls it also. I think you're on your way. I think yeah, you're on your way to being a tofu
kind of guy. It was looking like a step
backwards
to go back to sugar consumption. But.
Yeah. You know, so let me recommend that book to you, The Anatomy of Food Addiction. You might take a look. I think it's kind of a peaceful book to read, and it might be helpful to you. But you're on your way. I mean, look at the success you've had so far. You've had such fantastic success in what you've done so far, cigarettes and alcohol. You're going to make it. You'll get
there.
Thank you much. You know, you'll be one of these nice old gents who's going to be eating tofu or something.
Maybe I'll get there yet.
Nice to talk to you.
Good day, Armand.
Okay. Thank you. Hey, this is Armand DeMille, 212-209-2900. I was pulled up to a place the other day, and a guy says to me, you know, you've got a very distinctive voice. And I said, well, maybe you heard it on the radio. And he said, oh, my gosh. He said, since I've been a baby, my mother, I want you, what was mom's name? My mother was listening to your program, and she listens to your program all the time. He says, and ever since I've been a baby, your voice has been in my house. And here he was now, he was a doorman. At a place, you know, a door attendant or working for a restaurant. And he said, I recognize your voice. He said, but I grew up on your voice. And I realize now that I've been on the air for about 20 years, roughly. And being on the air 20 years, there are people who were just born and they heard this voice all the time. So his name is Chen. And to Chen's mom, wherever she is, I want to shout out a hello as well. You got a wonderful son. 212-209-2900. This is Armand DeMille. Let's take one more call. Hi, you're on the air.
Hello, Armand.
Yes.
This is Edward.
Hello, Edward.
From Brooklyn.
I know, Edward.
I love supermarkets. I think that there was times when we didn't have enough food when I was young.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes I'll just wander around the supermarket, like, looking at all the food.
But you're not a big consumer of food. You're a relatively thin guy.
I love food, though.
But you love it. You love the idea of it and the look of it, and you love to be loved. And you love love itself, don't you?
Yeah, it's true.
Yeah.
That's the best thing.
Supermarkets, to me, are always amazing. If I go to a city or if I go to another country, first thing I always want to do is go to the supermarket. I want to see how people position their foods, how they advertise their foods. I like to see what are the hot items and what are not, you know, how they, what different colors they use.
Yeah, sure.
So, and for you, you have never had, do you have much of a problem with food itself?
Not so much now. I mean, I used to drink a lot, but I don't do any of the substances. I don't really even have sugar much at all, a little bit of honey.
Because you've decided to clean up your life.
Oh, yeah, I live a very clean life. I like green juice now.
Good old green juice. I like green juice, too. Thanks. It really is fantastic.
That's my comfort food, mostly.
You know, it's a funny thing, yeah. You know, if it weren't for having to clean out the juicer, the thing is really a terrific thing. Well, thanks for calling in.
Thanks, Armand. I love the show, and I think it's a you know, looking at what's going on physically, it's another great way of learning about human, you know, our humanity.
You know, I asked the other day for a if anybody could send me a sentence. I received a few as to how you would describe the Positive Mind radio program. You know, a few words, like you just said, a gift to humanity. I'd love to get those from people, and they could feel free to email those to me at armand@thepositivemind.com. I'd like to hear your descriptions of the radio program. Thanks for calling in, Edward.
Thanks, Armand.
Sure. This is Armand DeMille with you at The Positive Mind. One more call. Hi there, you're on the air. Hello there.
Hello?
Yes.
Is this the Armand DeMille show?
It is the Armand DeMille show.
Oh, wow, I'm on the air.
You
okay.
Are certainly on the air.
Hi, I was calling. I was in the supermarket over the weekend, and I saw this Asian family, and it was mother and her five-year-old daughter. They were in the produce department picking out fruit. And the little girl picked up a big orange and presented it to her mother, and her mother gave her a big smile and said, "Great choice." And the kid was smiling from ear to ear, you know. And I think about what you're saying in terms of, like, as children, how we associate different foods with these experiences. And that just jumped out at me from what I saw over the weekend.
Amazing. Let me ask you one thing. Can you imagine a moment when you, what fruit would you have loved to, what would you have loved to have offered your mother? Imagine offering it to your mother. Imagine offering your mother an orange and her saying, "Great choice, son."
Oh, yeah.
Right? Did she ever do that to you?
No. It was milk and cookies for me.
Milk and cookies. And she would, this is your relationship to her, right?
Yes.
The milk and cookies. Yeah. Was it ever difficult?
Well, I don't know. I mean, for me, that's just what I always go back to. That's my comfort food, you know? And I'm a middle-aged guy, so, you know.
You should try an orange. I'm only kidding. What you really responded to with that child was not the orange, but the love between the child and the parent.
I did. It was beautiful. And it struck me that day, and it just, you know, I thought back to it just now, listening to the show, but it struck me that day. It was just, it really was. It was beautiful. And I'm sure the mother didn't even think twice about what she was doing. Maybe she did. I don't know. But it's a happy kid.
Well, I sound like you are, too. I want to thank you for calling in. This is Armand DeMille with you with The Positive Mind. We're going to have to be going soon. I'm going to leave you with some Miriam Makeba. And we'll be back with you tomorrow at 1 p.m. with some exercises for the child's soul. Be sure to tune in. Back with you tomorrow at 1. If you want to send me an email, it's Armand@thepositivemind.com.